You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I cannot believe this next guest. And this is the direction the podcast has been going, to be more story-driven. But this next guest, he started the band Sha-na-na. Now, if you're younger, you might not have heard about them, but Sha-na-na was a hugely popular rock and roll band. They opened for Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock. Bruce Springsteen, when he was young, opened for Sha-na-na. They traveled and toured with the Grateful Dead, with Janis Joplin, with others. They were one of the biggest bands on the planet. And then they even had one of the most popular TV shows from 1977 to 1981. I watched it every week. It was called Sha-na-na, and the band would have guests and play music and so on. Anyway, this next guest, Robert Leonard, he started the band with the help of his friend Jimi Hendrix, and then he quit and became one of the leading forensic linguists on the planet. Now, I'll let him describe what forensic linguistics is, but he's basically involved in murder cases like JonBenet Ramsey and the Unabomber and all sorts of other cases that are fascinating, and how he helps solve these cases is just amazing. But also, I really love that he made this kind of transition from being a huge rock star to being the most prominent forensic linguist on the planet. So, and he's got such amazing stories to tell. I'll let him tell them. Here's Robert Leonard. Robert, first, you got to tell me, you've gone from the group Sha-na-na, which I loved as a kid, I can't believe I'm talking to you, to being involved in forensic linguistics, which I don't even know what that is. And you worked on the JonBenet Ramsey case. You've worked on all sorts of cases. It's an incredible, I love stories of transition. I think it's particularly important now, as so many people are going through their own transitions amidst this pandemic and, you know, strange kind of economy. But first, Sha-na-na, what the hell happened? How did you guys start? I mean, I know, but explain to the listeners.
If you like transitions, you've come to the right place, because
I know
I've really gone through so many transitions that are so wildly different, and no one could ever be more astonished than I was.
I mean, you Sha-na-na was almost like you put on the act. You normalized kind of the gang, drug, rock and roll. You made it kind of salient for kids. You had the TV show Sha-na-na, but meanwhile, Sha-na-na got started in part because of your buddy Jimi Hendrix.
That's right. Yeah, and it was really invented by my brother, who also went to Columbia. This starts actually at Columbia University, where
I was in
what's now would be an a cappella group. I was the leader, and we didn't do a lot. I mean, we would go across the street and play in the psychiatric ward at St. Luke's Hospital, and we'd go to all female schools, and that's about what we did. I mean, we didn't take ourselves very seriously, and we didn't have a lot of numbers prepared. So when somebody actually said that they were going to have a record producer come and listen to us, we had to get all these new songs. And at that point in 1969, rock and roll was not exactly filled with beautiful harmonies. And you can probably hear I'm a second bass, but we loved the songs of our older brothers, the doo-wop. And we used to sing them as we'd leave rehearsal, literally under the streetlights, Broadway. And we knew all these songs, and we knew all the harmonies. So we said, oh, let's do that. So we sang 50 songs. Now, this was the first time anybody was singing 50 songs in what then was a long time. And everybody went crazy. And then my brother, George Leonard, who goes on to be a fabulous novelist, screenwriter for Ron Howard and everything else. And now he's a grad student. And he says, I have an idea. Call the boys to your apartment. I said, really? Yes. I said, okay. So I call the boys to my apartment. And then my brother says, boys, and he points at everybody's face and he says, boys, I'm going to make you rock and roll stars. So you can imagine everybody signed right up. No, of course not. Nobody believed him. We said, what are you, crazy? And he says, listen, you saw the reaction. I went around to the fraternities and had them grease up and everything. This is a brand new idea. We're going to revitalize the 50 songs. And he then choreographed us, dressed us in, you know, the faux hood. I wore a gold lamé suit like Elvis Presley. And he had us doing all this fabulous dance routines. Again, totally opposite of what was going on in rock and roll at the time. And we played at Columbia and people were just tearing the walls apart. They couldn't believe it. That summer, we went around to all the nightclubs in New York saying, hey, are you interested in our act? And they said, what are you, out of your mind?
What? Just out of curiosity, what clubs in New York did you go to? Like, what existed back then?
That's a good question, because most of the ones that I'm remembering are ones that we played in later. But we hit pay dirt on Steve Paul's The Scene, which was the most inside nightclub in all of New York City. Matter of fact, it's so inside that I don't even think it has a Wikipedia page. It made Studio 54 look like, I don't know, Walmart or something. It was subterranean. I think it was 47th Street, west of 8th Avenue. It was under a house of ill repute in the basement.
Yeah, because west of 47th Street, west of 8th Avenue on 47th Street, that was Hell's Kitchen. That was a pretty bad area right then.
It was a very, very bad area. And it was all porno and really rough, nasty porno shops and prostitutes lining the streets. It was real New York, right? So, and underneath here was Steve Paul's Scene, half owned by Andy Warhol, who understood and really appreciated what avant-garde meant. And they loved us. And they said, yeah, sure, come play tonight. I mean, bands would pay to play there because there you were going to see Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and everybody else who, when they didn't have a gig, they would come and play there. They would jam and they would hang out. So people didn't have these entourages like they do now. So we became just about the house band, and the Village Voice, which was a big newspaper at the time, really broke the story of us. They loved us. People started flocking to us. And I had the death songs, Tell Laura I Love Her, Teen Angel, where, the teenage romance ends with death. And
is that song, Teen Angel, is that what I'm thinking of? Is that the popular song, Teen Angel?
That fateful night, the car was stalled upon the railroad track. I pulled
that's out. A great song.
Yeah, and we were saved, but you went running back. So what was it you were looking for that took your life that night? They said they found my high school ring clutched in your fingers tight.
So did you guys write that, or was that a cover?
Oh, no, it was a cover. All of our songs at that point in time were very decidedly and on purpose covered, because we were trying to recreate what people remembered about the 50s. And we were an a cappella group. So we had 12 guys doing 4- and 5-part harmony, which, you know, they didn't then. And we played it the way people remembered it. Everybody said, oh, that's exactly. No, it wasn't. Because I played it straight. I played it from the heart. And then in the middle of it, I cry, they buried you today. Whereas if you listen to the original one, it was, they buried you today, you know? So it was a show. It was a musical. It was vaudeville. Each of these songs was a different plot. Each song had a different narrator, a different front man. So one night, I go, Teen Angel, answer me. And I go to my knees, please. And I look up, and there, not 6 feet away, is Jimi Hendrix jumping up and down on a chair. You know, it's very small place. It's about as big as a normal living room, I think, in a big house. And He's going, yeah, right, yes. And he came over and he pumped my hand and we drank that night. I mean, Jimi Hendrix taught me how to drink tequila with the lime and the salt, you know? And
when you describe it that way, I'm sorry to interrupt. When you describe it that way, that's kind of how, I mean, I'm not a drinker, but that's kind of how everybody drinks tequila. You sound very like a Columbia student being taught how to drink by Jimi Hendrix.
I was 19, I think. And what do I know? God almighty. And I wasn't used to drinking in bars. And
were you in awe of Woodstock hadn't happened yet, right? So were you in awe of Jimi Hendrix? Had people realized this is like the greatest guitar player ever?
Absolutely. And the only person I knew, I'd never been to a rock concert until I performed at a rock concert. I was in love with soul music. And we would go down to 125th Street to the Apollo Theater and see all those fabulous harmony groups. And I didn't know anything about rock and roll except the 50s stuff. But I knew Jimi Hendrix, you know, Hey Joe and all of those. Fabulous, fabulous, and the greatest guitarist in the world.
And what was he like in person? Because, again, I think he was an enigmatic sort of character. Like, I don't know anybody else, actually, who's hung out with him. I just know, like, stuff from his biography and things like that. Like, what was he like just hanging out with him?
Yeah, and actually, that was the story I was about to tell, that we were drinking and talking about everything, and he's telling me, he was like my guide to the rock and roll world. You know, it was, hey, little brother, listen to this, right? This is how it works, and this is what to do. And I was very reluctant to become, I had wanted to go to Europe that summer with my girlfriend. I didn't want to hang around and beat doors to clubs that didn't want us. So we go into the men's room, and this guy follows us in, and he pulls a camera out from under his coat, and he tries to sell it to Jimmy. And Jimmy says, what are you doing, man? Come on, brother. That's hot, right? Well, I mean, just $20 is all. Now, listen. Here's $20. Now, go take that camera and put it back wherever you found it. Because otherwise, man, you're going to wind up in jail. Your kids aren't going to have a father. Take the $20 and get out of here. And he did. He was just the nicest guy in the world. And it turned out that our guitarist, Henry Gross, in Brooklyn, used to play with Jimmy before he was Jimi Hendrix and went off to Vietnam. And it was just, boy, it was amazing. But he was just the nicest guy in the world. And one of my fondest scenes in the whole world is in the Woodstock movie director's cut. They have of me doing Teen Angel, although rather off key, having spent the whole night on the stage. And as I'm singing, there's Jimmy nodding, smiling, watching me, because he went on right after us.
So would you open for Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock?
That's right. We played before him. And see, it was so late. Everybody was behind, you know, it was a mess, that place. And they said to Jimmy, look, Jimmy, you want to go on now? And he said, no, there are groups that haven't gone on. Sean hasn't gone on. And he waited for us to go on. And then he went on, because he was supposed to go on like midnight. And he went on at 7 or 8 or 9 in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was pretty amazing.
Among your other amazing stories, Bruce Springsteen opened for you guys, right? When he was just starting out.
Yeah. A lot of people opened for us. I know. It's just amazing when I look at some of the sets to see who opened for us. You know, Santana, stuff like that.
Like, what was Bruce Springsteen like? Well, he was a little kid.
I never met Springsteen that I can remember. But, you know, as they say, if you were in the 60s, you don't remember the 60s. But I didn't take drugs. I had an experience that ruined me forever and ever, which was very lucky for me. Because as I moved through my life, I was in areas where everybody I knew was dying of drug overdoses. And I studied in Bangkok after leaving Africa, which is all other transitional story. And I was very lucky about that.
What was your bad experience with drugs?
Yeah, it was just a bad experience with drugs. And it made me absolutely never want to go near any drugs. Alcohol, okay, but not drugs. And, you know, one of the reasons I got out of Sha-na-na was we were at the pinnacle of our success. And everybody I knew started dying of drug overdoses. I used to sit at the Fillmore West in San Francisco backstage with Janis Joplin. And she would hang out and we would talk and she would complain to me about the lack of male groupies. I said, I don't exactly know how to answer what to say about that, Janis. And I always drank her wine. And that was because at the Fillmore West, it was like a big gymnasium, literally it was. And people would open a bottle of wine and put PCP in it and drink it and pass it along. And these bottles would go throughout the entire audience and everybody would put more and more drugs in it. So I was petrified of that. I didn't know what the hell I'd be drinking. So I didn't. I only drank Janice's wine because she didn't take drugs like me. And why I didn't just buy a bottle of my own wine, I don't know. But it was a lot of fun hanging out with Janis. And of course, then Janis dies of an overdose of drugs.
Yeah, how did she get, how do you think, were you around her when she's got started, you know, using heroin and other drugs?
None of the people that I knew who knew her pretty well, and we played with her just a couple of months before she died in Calgary, Canada, on the, what was called the Festival Express, the Canadian Woodstock train, knew that she was, but you see, like at that Calgary show, she sang one of the best performances I ever saw of hers. This is in this video, the Festival Express. And we were there, the Dead and everybody. And there was this Rotgut tequila floating around in the backstage area and in the hotel, the party. And I could barely drink it. And we used to drink a lot of really bad tequila. But Janis got up and cracked the bottle of a fifth of this tequila and drank the entire bottle straight during the downtimes in her set. So that was in around 5 minutes, maybe, or 6 minutes that she wasn't actually singing. And it didn't affect her pitch at all. Which
so suggests, she had a really high tolerance for this sort
exactly,
of stuff.
Yeah. So maybe she had maxed out her ability to get anything out of alcohol, and she probably needed a ton of alcohol just to be normal. I mean, I'm no expert on this, but that's how it seems to a lot of people. So she had to go to the next level up, unfortunately.
Now, let me ask, and this is going to segue into something else, but Janis Joplin was an amazing musician, and she was also incredibly beautiful. And here you were hanging out with her, friends with her. Did you ever make a move on her?
Nope.
Fair enough. And, you know, a lot, you know, the saying the 60s was about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. She really exemplified that. And as did Jimi Hendrix. And you guys did not. I feel like Sha-na-na is a very 70s phenomenon where the 70s and media in the 70s kind of normalized the 60s movement and made it family friendly. And I feel Sha-na-na was part of that trend.
Well, I'm glad we escaped scrutiny then. That's pretty good. Actually, very unfortunately, our own lead guitarist died of an overdose of heroin after I left. But I think one of the reasons you get that impression is because, I mean, I've read history books that credit us with starting punk rock. And
really?
Yeah. Where we didn't, Sid Vicious is quoted in some biography of him saying, wait a minute, I can't talk now. Sha-na-na's on TV. They're me favorite.
Oh my God. I got to look that up.
But when the TV show came around and I was out of the group already, I had decided to give it up. I reluctantly went back to Columbia. I reluctantly left the group, which I had reluctantly joined, because Columbia offered me a full fellowship, a free ride, no teaching, stipends, living expenses, no tuition, all the way to the PhD.
And so let me ask about that, because I think this is a big transition for you. I understand they gave you a free scholarship, but you were in Sha-na-na. You know, you guys were about to do one of the most watched TV shows of all time.
Yeah.
And what was the decision like? Like, were you, did you ever regret it? Were you really torn, or were you just?
I regretted it all the time, and I was torn all the time. I loved the guys in the group. I loved being in the group. I loved all sorts of things about the group.
Plus, there's the promise of money. You guys were already like a world famous band, and everyone was on the verge. You know, music was changing. Everybody was on the verge of making, you know, a huge amount of money.
And we were amazingly already in the top 25. I remember Billboard saying, I think, a top 25 paid groups. Not that we were paid a lot in those dollars, but in these dollars we were. I said to myself, I have two divergent paths now. I can either stay in Sha-na-na and certainly never get my doctorate in linguistics, or I can leave Sha-na-na and go to Columbia Graduate School. I was a student the entire time I was in Sha-na-na. And I said, I'm never going to be able to come back to that node and make that decision. So very reluctantly, I said, let me throw in with the PhD. And I left. But it was made easier, if that's the word, because everybody I knew was dying. I mean, you know a lot about show business, and you know show business ain't what it's cracked up to be. And it's a lot of terrible things that happen in show business. And there are these ugly, awful experiences of people that you really, really adore dying. And there was so much excess of drugs and drinking and, yeah, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, people were dying all over the place. So that helped me move.
But now, you know, the Sha-na-na, the band, continued, obviously, and had so many great highlights, like one of the most watched shows of all time. It was a syndicated kind of feature show, I guess, from in the late 70s to early 80s. Sha-na-na was in the movie Grease.
Well, Grease was a movie about us, you understand. I mean, they got all that from us. Even the word Grease was not used the way they do in the Grease Broadway show and movie until my brother decided to call our second Columbia concert Grease Under the Stars, and the glory that was Grease. It comes from a poem, the glory that was Grease, the grandeur that was Rome. And so that's why we used Grease and Greaser. That was not the term for guys like us. It was hoods.
And that's what I mean. Like, even Grease, the movie, sort of normalized
yes.
hoods.
Yes.
So you weren't gangsters with the leather jackets doing drugs. You were singing nice songs.
These historians explain that we invented the 50s as opposed to, let's say, the 1950s. The 1950s was a terrible time. There was McCarthyism. There was just all sorts of horrendous things happening. But we invented a make-believe version, a pre-1968, when the world blew up because of the Vietnam War. Columbia students took over the school and occupied all the buildings and with guns kept the dean hostage for days. I mean, and people, you think people were at each other's throats now? Then every male over 18, every single male, had a target on his back and could, in the blink of an eye, dematerialize and rematerialize in a rice paddy in Vietnam. About 25 of the guys that I went to high school with died in Vietnam, and for what? So this was a way of healing, for example, the Columbia campus, who were just at each other's throats because they could look back to this make-believe world of the 50s when everything was cool. Of course, it wasn't, but at least it wasn't the same problems. And again, that's what historians say we did, and that was what my brother tried to do.
It's so interesting you say that, because it also, and I would say you reinvented the 50s and the 60s in the sense that
you were rock and roll,
but family-friendly. You know, like, it wasn't like, you know, Jimi Hendrix was going to do a family TV show at 8 p.m. on a Friday night.
Well, the TV show, of course, appealed on two levels, because the parents they remembered the songs because they were older than us and they grew up with them, see? And then the little kids, what did they know? They just saw us doing all this broad comedy with Groucho Marx and everything. But I wasn't in the TV show. By the time the TV show came around, I had gotten a Fulbright fellowship to do my doctoral dissertation research in East Africa. And I was in East Africa studying the northern dialects of Swahili up by the Mali coast.
So at that time, though, like, did you ever say, hey, can I just be on an episode or two of the show? Can I be in Greece? Did you ever, like, kind of ask, I guess your brother was still involved, you ever kind of say, hey, can I just hang out a little bit and maybe sing some songs?
My brother wasn't involved anymore. As a matter of fact, he just put us in, he put us into motion. He choreographed 30 or 40 of our songs, and then he went off with his girlfriend to Europe someplace. And I had to handle Woodstock all by myself without my brother helping. God, there's so much reluctance. Really, at every turn, I never, I can admit, had the courage to say, oh, that's fine, I'll do it. And how we got to Woodstock, just to go back to that node, okay, I go back to our dressing room at the scene, and this is about as big as the coffee table in front of me, and there is this super stoned hippie right out of Central Casting, long hair and pinwheels for eyes, and he's giving me a peace sign, and he's saying, you guys, and I said, oh, yeah, man, thanks. Oh, it's really nice of you. And I took him, and I started to walk him out, and just about to push him out the door, our manager, who was my brother's buddy from Colombia, wonderful guy named Ed Goodgold, sort of gets in our way, and we all fall down on the floor. And Ed gets up, and he picks up this stoned hippie, and he's, like, brushing him off. And the hippie, like, nothing happened. He just flashes the sign again and says, you guys have to be at Woodstock. And I said to Ed, what's Woodstock? He says, I guess we'll find out. And I had almost thrown out Mike Lang, one of the principals of Woodstock. And he had come because Jimi Hendrix, we are told, recommended, hey, go to the scene and see these guys. They have to be at Woodstock. So it was a good thing that Ed stopped me, because that night, organized crime closed the scene forever with tear gas and attacks. And our guitarist, 80-year-old grandmother, was there. My parents were there, my father in his jacket and tie, in this den of iniquity. It's really interesting.
Two more questions, and then I want to get to the forensic linguistic stuff, which I'm actually more interested in. But, you know, you guys had a very far-reaching effect. Like, I was reading how this rebel, and then later, I think, president of East Timor, named himself Shanana.
Really?
Because of you guys.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, his name's Shanana Gusmeo, and he spells it X-A-N-A-N-A. And he named himself after Shanana.
It could be him and Sid Vicious, right? Real fans.
Well, he said that the name comes from, he pronounces Shanana, and he says it comes from the American.
That's great.
Group.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, man, I would love to see anything with that in it. That's really
okay. And then the other thing is, when you went back to graduate school at Columbia and you're studying linguistics, did your fellow classmates know you had been, you know, one of the main singers of the group Shanana? Were they all in awe of you? Were you like the stud of Columbia's campus?
Well, it was interesting because when I was in the group, by day, I was just a normal schmucky college student. But at night, playing with Jimi Hendrix and the Grateful Dead, dressed in gold lamé, Teen Angel, and all that, that was really great. I tried to keep a lower profile when I was in grad school, but my professors all knew, and they were very protective of me because I was still in the group my first year of graduate school. And I would come in Monday morning to the head of the department's class, sit down, and promptly fall asleep. I'd have my overcoat and my suitcase. And he was great. Every now and then he'd say to the guy next to me, would someone wake up Mr. Leonard, please? I'm coming to a very important point, and I don't want him to miss it. They'd wake me up, I would listen to the very important point, make my notes, and promptly fall back asleep. So that was, I knew I couldn't do both.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. You're one of the few people who really hit the top of success in two entirely different fields. I mean, you're considered one of the best forensic linguists in the world. And, you know, you studied it for many years and you've been involved in so many different cases. But can you describe just what is a forensic linguist? Like, forensic means you studied death cases and you've helped out everybody from the NYPD to the FBI to working on so many different, you know, famous cases, but I'm sure many other cases as well. But what does linguistics have to do with it?
Sure. And let me add to that, that I founded a forensic linguistics death penalty capital case innocence project at Hofstra, where I teach and where I have a graduate program, about the only face-to-face graduate program in the Western Hemisphere in forensic linguistics. And there, my graduate student interns, supervised by me and other faculty and the law school, we reanalyze language evidence that put people on death row. And very often we find that this language evidence was improperly, unscientifically analyzed, or is just false sometimes. And we also help investigators. A year and a half ago, my interns and I helped investigators track a serial killer through the South. A woman was marrying and bumping off serially veterans. And
wow.
Staging.
Why was she doing that?
Because she knew about veterans very well. So she would marry somebody, claim benefits for children that she did not have with the person, empty his bank account, and then stage a suicide, one bullet to the head. And she'd gotten away with it. And then another crime, and we don't even know how many. We know one guy who got away. So we helped the investigators prove, or the high likelihood, that the first guy's suicide note had not been written by him, but had been written by her.
Wow. And how, so
that's what linguistics is. Linguistics is the scientific study of language. Most of what people know about language consciously, I mean, we all know unconsciously, we're perfect speakers of our native languages, but most of what we know consciously is from classes that are trying to get us to stop speaking normally and write in educated standard English, right? So, you know, you have a grammar class and it doesn't describe how people actually use language. It says what you should do if you want to follow the rules. And that's very useful. But linguists study actual, what's called authentic data, what actually comes out of people's mouths and keyboards. And one of the ways we do this is through something called sociolinguistic research. And that was what I was doing in East Africa for years. And I also went to Bangkok and did it in Thai. And I did it in Detroit in English. And I did it in London in English. And I did it in Puerto Rico in Spanish, where we take actual real world samples of how people are actually using language. And over the years, over the decades, thousands and thousands and thousands of samples have been collected like this from all over the world by sociolinguists. And we get an extremely good picture of how people really use language, what dialects are, what subdialects are. Every time you open your mouth or sit down at a keyboard, you are revealing so much information about yourself that you're not aware of. And a forensic linguist can analyze that and see perhaps what country you're from, where you have lived, what sports you watch.
Absolutely.
What movie? I mean, if you use the term, my shot clock was running out. Well, you show that you know basketball, but you could say that to a lot of people and they would have no idea what you're talking about. Native language, certainly, your occupation, your training, your education, your age.
Boy, I'm fascinated. I wonder, like, if you saw, like, let's say I'm the average person, like, and you saw my writing, would you really be able to determine lots of things about me other than that I am probably from the Northeast in the United States?
Yes.
Like what, if you just saw a sample of my writing, what would you be, and I'm a professional writer, like what would you be able to determine, you think?
Well, all of those things, for example. I mean, yeah. That you're a native English speaker. If you say, it depends on what is in the sample. See, in forensic, just before I'll answer that question in a sec, but forensic means, I remember a detective I was training, the NYPD captain, he said, I don't know, Rob, to me, forensic means a chalk outline of a body on the street. I said, I know, but it gets too complicated to say language applied to law. So forensic linguistics has come to mean any application of the science of linguistics, of scientific linguistic analysis, to any issue of the law. So it could be the JonBenet Ramsey case, as you mentioned before. I was Apple's linguist against both Microsoft and Amazon in their trademark battle on App Store.
Right. So I read about that. There's like a scientific paper about that. And I don't quite understand, like, what were you looking for linguistically to show that Apple was, you know, first in their yeah. trademark?
Well, it was very clear that Apple invented the term App Store. They had somebody else had started to say it and then said, no, you take it over. So App Store didn't exist until Apple. And Microsoft and Amazon wanted to be able to use the term App Store. And they said no. And those guys said, well, it's generic. You can't trademark a generic word. Like, you and I could not start a salt company and trademark the word salt, because that would exclude everybody else in the world who makes salt, okay, from using that term. So you have to have a certain kind of non-generic, and I won't get into the weeds on generic, descriptive, suggestive, etc. But I argued that actual data showed, among other things, that 85% of the people in my study, and I used various identified App Store as an Apple thing and not as the others and not as generic. And they said, well, look, app is generic, store is generic, but you put them together, you have to take trademarks as a unit. And they said, look, it's just like shoe store. That's generic. You can't have, you know, Leonard's shoe store and not have anybody else use shoe store. I said, it isn't at all. Number one, what do you do in a shoe store? You buy something. You don't buy anything in App Store. And you could buy a pair of shoes, go out on the street and resell it. Can't do that with App Store. It's a metaphor for store. It's not bricks and mortar. Also, app was generic. Store was generic. But you put them together and you get a brand new concept. And this is how language works. Look at, you'll remember a couple of years back, the movement called Occupy Wall Street. Occupy, normal everyday old word. Wall Street, normal phrase. But put them together, it's a brand new concept. And that's what I said was with App Store. And the judge agreed with me. He said it wasn't generic.
Using linguistics, is someone's writing style and patterns, is that almost as unique as a fingerprint? Or how close is that metaphor to accurate?
Right. So people sometimes try to explain it to non-linguists as sort of a fingerprint, but there's a lot of difference with a fingerprint. Because number one, your fingerprint doesn't change. Your personal dialect changes every 5 minutes. For example, I now know what the word squadcast is because I'm staring at it the entire time. So my own individual dialect will change. It changes over time, depending on who you talked to last week. And this is why it's so useful. We can track people through their language. So my mentor, Roger Shuy, S-H-U-Y, he was a professor at Georgetown, still works with me as my partner. He was able to analyze the Unabomber's manifesto. And you remember, the Unabomber was this guy who for 14, 17 years kept bombing places. They couldn't catch him. He was very, very clever and innovative. He would manufacture all his bomb things, so they couldn't even find this bomb device was bought in a place in Albuquerque. But so Roger looks at his 300, it was a long manifesto, I can't remember how long now, and he said, the person who wrote this is not, as they've been suspecting, a not-so-educated person like an aircraft repairman, which is one of the things they thought he might be. He said, this person has a graduate degree, but not in the humanities. He was brought up in Chicago, a Catholic.
How did he guess Catholic?
Because he used terms like sublimation, which especially then was a way that the Catholic Church was telling its teenagers not to have sex, you see? Huh. And so also he did misspellings, but they weren't real misspellings. Roger recognized them as Chicago Tribune new way of simplifying spelling, which only lasted for a certain period. When the publisher died, they went back to the normal spelling. And he also talked about rearing children, which at that time was in the dialect that we call northern cities, as opposed to raising children. Okay. And he said he has lived in the West, but he's not from the West. And he knew that because in the manifesto, he said, I had gone out into the Sierra to meditate or something. And Sierra is a topographical term used in the West, but it was the only topographical term he used. See, if he was a local, he would have been using all these other terms. But somehow he had picked that up, just like I picked up now the term squadcast.
Right. And so I remember, like, about the learned part, like he was using words like tautology, for instance. And so that kind of led to the theory that he was highly educated. How did he determine that he wasn't in the humanities, but he was in the sciences?
Well, you have to remember, Roger and I are college professors, and the way it was laid out and everything would not have been up to the standard of a humanities or social science. And indeed, Kaczynski had a PhD in mathematics.
Huh, fascinating. Like in the case of this woman who was marrying veterans and then faking their suicides, yes. And presumably they would write suicide notes, you could basically use linguistic analysis to say, oh, this note is not in the patterns that are very common for this man, but it is common for this woman.
Perfectly put. Yes. And I'll give you one example, which was these guys are veterans. They knew military terminology. She was never in the service, so she only knew it secondhand. So she used to make a lot of mistakes. She wouldn't capitalize things that were supposed to be capitalized. She would misuse a term as the wrong part of speech. But the guys never would, see? Hmm. And here we have in the suicide note all these misuses of military terms that happen to perfectly coincide with hers.
And statistically, would you look at statistically how often veterans would misuse words in, you know, because veterans maybe in some cases weren't that educated, so they might misuse words.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know if it's a something about education, but we establish reference corpora of these. We get real world samples, just like I did in the northern dialects of Swahili in northern Kenya. And we studied not only military manuals, but social media, where people who were in families of military would speak. So we would get a large sample of how all these different populations might use these military terms. And she was quite an outlier. And if you're an outlier and you find that outlying, you know, idiosyncrasy thing in both the document that you're analyzing and somebody's writing, that's one link that would help you look at that person. But you can't do things on the basis of one feature. You always have to have a series of features. And I've testified in this, and it's been accepted in court in murder trials. That's how I really got into this. I was asked by the Pennsylvania State Police to analyze these two letters, a sort of threatening letter to a woman. The woman then was found strangled in her car. And then another letter which said, "You're looking at the wrong person. I killed her." And the police, I realized, of course, probably thought it was the same person. And they were wildly different on the surface. But I was able to show from the narrative structures and other things, and the fact that they actually did show the same level of education, et cetera, that they were probably written by the same person. And they actually also shared a very, very rare rhetorical device that was so rare we had to give it a name, called ironic repetition. So in the first letter, it was, "I would have loved to have found out. She made sure my fiance found out." And in the second letter, it was, "She broke it off, so I broke her neck."
Interesting.
So these are these short letters, but they both have that rhetorical device of repetition for ironic effect and cruel humor. And that allowed the judge to give us a search warrant, and then we had all the writings of the suspect.
If I was playing devil's advocate, like let's say I'm the defense attorney for this woman, I could say, well, you have a hammer, so everything's a nail. So you even had to make up a rhetorical device to sort of show that these letters are similar. But in fact, there's probably everybody occasionally uses, you know, some degree of repetition in their letters.
Very, very good. So what I did when I saw this, and I looked at it for weeks before I noticed it, is I researched whether it was a common rhetorical device. I asked all the Greek and Latin professors at Hofstra, and they said, gee, no. And then I went to the Brigham Young University encyclopedia of all the rhetorical devices in the world and spoke to its curator. And I said, is this a common rhetorical device? Now, John F. Kennedy, president, in his first speech, he very famously said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." And he was accused of having plagiarized that by all sorts of people. But that's because that was a very common rhetorical device that probably went all the way back to ancient Athens.
But yeah, I think it's called anaphora, right?
Mm-hmm. And there's even anaphora, absolutely. But there's also a word. I'm not an expert on rhetorical devices. That's why I rely on people who are Greek and Latin professors and the keeper of the enormous thing. And he said, no, I mean, it's sort of cloche, but it isn't really. And again, all we needed to do was convince a judge that language evidence could come in handy.
I see. And did a judge ever say, this is just like astrology, forget it?
No, actually. But they sometimes say, well, the other side will always try to knock me out, right? Because obviously if one side is presenting me, it's in their interest. Because if I do an analysis and I say, you don't have anything here, obviously they don't try to present me at trial, right? So what people do say is, judge, we don't need a professional linguist. You speak English. The jury speaks English. And sometimes that can make sense. But one case I had about judicial misconduct had 250,000 pages of evidence in Spanish. So nobody thinks that the jury is going to retire to the jury room and go through that. And you need really advanced scientific methods of analysis.
And also you can argue that the average jury member is not going to know statistically how much a certain phrase is used
right.
by people from California. And you
right.
might have some of that knowledge based on
that's right.
Well, newspaper articles or whatever.
Oh, no, we have a lot of data on how people speak in California and in Sri Lanka. There are enormous corpora, these intentional curated databases that that are compendiums of actual language used in English in all the world's countries that use English and like that. But, you know, to get back to what you and I were speaking about at the outset, which was that you're from New York, but you're down in Florida. And what could I tell from your language? Well, I'll give you an example. And I'll give you an example how you really have to go not by your instinct, but by databases, by corpora. Let's say we have a threat case in California. And this guy is stalking this woman and the writing notes, and he says, "Hey, baby, when I saw you standing online in the supermarket, I knew you were the one for me." And they look around at all the possible suspects, and they get samples of writing. And this one guy, he says, "Dear mom, I was standing online in the supermarket, and I remember how you used to make me chicken." So they say, "Wow, look at this. What an idiosyncrasy. Standing online? Who the hell says that? It must be this guy." But actually what they've done is just narrow the suspect pool down to the 9 or 10 million people in the New York area, where in the supermarket, we stand online. But in California, you stand in line. Hmm. See? And these are unconscious uses. So we are revealing things about ourselves all the time, which is really interesting because on the other side of the coin, there's very, very, very amazingly little information in the words we speak. Most of the information that you get when you're speaking to somebody comes from the mind of the listener, not the words. The words are triggering knowledge, things called schemas, in the mind of the listener. And there's good demonstrations of this I do all the time, convincing a judge that there's more to language than meets the eye. And I can do it if you want. It's 4 sentences.
Sure.
John was on his way to school last Friday. He was really worried about the math lesson. What's John? Just play along now. What do you think?
I would assume I'm picturing a kid who's like 8 or 9 years old.
Right.
Because that's middle America.
That's right. Perfect. That's your default schema. How's he getting to school?
I pictured walking, but it could be by bus or walking.
Perfect. Perfect. And that's what most people say, either one or the other. All right. So we've communicated. But wait a minute. Have we communicated? Is he on the bus or is he walking or is he skydiving? I didn't say he wasn't skydiving.
Also, John's parent is probably writing this note, not John himself.
Well, now that's really insightful, man, because so much of this is theory of mind and negotiation with who the interlocutor is. John was on his way to school last Friday. He was really worried about the math lesson. Last week, he had been unable to control the class. Now what is he?
He's a teacher.
That's right. Now how's he going to school?
Car.
That's right. So I was training officers in Denmark. And when I asked them, how's he going to school? Every single person in the class said, on his bike. Huh. See, just as you said, you're imagining that it's the intent. You have to negotiate who it is you're talking to and what words are going to trigger what responses. John was on his way to school last Friday. He was really worried about the math lesson. Last week, he'd been unable to control the class. It had been unfair of the math teacher to leave him in charge. Now what is he?
Yeah, now he's a student again.
Well, he could be a student, or he could be a substitute teacher, or he could be an assistant teacher.
Yeah, or a
teacher.
TA or something.
Right.
Yeah.
So I've done a lot of research with this and asked people. And one person said to me, you know, I've never had a substitute teacher who couldn't control a class, but I know it's a thing. So I'm assuming that the person who wrote that intended for me to think it was a substitute teacher because I know it's a thing that they can't control the class. So where's all this information coming from? Not in the words. It's in the interpretation of the words. It's in the schemas, these knowledge bases. After all, it's not a normal part of a janitor's duties. This is from a book on how we get meaning from reading. Great book.
I have two more devil's advocate questions. So one is, what's the difference between coincidence and statistical accuracy? So in the example where I was standing online in one letter and I was standing online in the other letter, and this comes from a pool of people who might be suspects. Now, people always say, oh my gosh, I ran into somebody from my childhood. What a coincidence.
Yeah.
And yet we know coincidences, some coincidences are not only possible, but it's almost impossible to not have coincidences in life because there's so many possible coincidences. Any one specific coincidence is odd.
That's right.
But you're going to have coincidences out of the billions of possible coincidences you could have. You're going to have coincidences every day, perhaps. And so it might be a coincidence. My favorite show is Sha-na-na. Now I'm talking to you. So in this case, the stand online, how do you know it's not just coincidence that, you know, people do this?
That's really excellent, excellent question. The answer to which will unwrap a whole bunch of other stuff. So as I had said before, you never go on one feature. That was bad procedure anyway, because maybe the guy had a girlfriend who was from New York, so he started saying online, right? So, and my colleague at Hofstra, Dr. Tammy Gales, she told me that when she came back from Greece, where she had been working, she was using English that her mother said, wait, that doesn't make sense. And then she realized that she had borrowed those constructions from Greek, even though she's a native speaker of English, and then went back. So it's certainly possible that somebody could pick up something like that. So there's a couple of things. You never go by one feature. There's always a constellation of features. And what we are actually doing is excluding candidates, very much like the people at the Human Genome Project explained to me DNA does. DNA, they told me, actually excludes people. And maybe you've excluded so many people that there are very few suspects left. But that's what we do. For example, I testified in a trial where a guy was accused of having sent himself death threats and death threats about his employer and his family for months and months, and then strangled his wife and two little boys to free himself so he could be with his new girlfriend. And I analyzed his known writings and I analyzed these threat letters. And there were a number of consistencies between the two. But in my report, I said, as I always do, I said, that the superior hypothesis is that, and you put it almost exactly the same way I do, that the linguistic features in the questioned document can be best explained as instances of those features that we find in the known documents. No matter how strong that is, this does not necessarily mean that this person wrote those letters. That has to be decided by the trier of fact, which is a judge or a jury, judge in a bench trial, based on all the forensic evidence, all the other evidence, and means, motive, and opportunity. So it is not the case that everybody who, you know, was in Chicago at that moment are actually viable suspects. There is always a suspect pool. This guy, and then it turned out one of those letters had been written on his work computer. But so we cannot identify one particular person in the world. And I always say that to investigators. The DEA wanted me, they wanted to know if I could testify in this one case I won't get into. Beyond a reasonable doubt, it was this person. I said, no, I've told you that before. And they said, yeah, we thought that too. Maybe has a twin brother who sits there at the computer with him and writes also. It's almost never the case that it's that wide open. You have a shrinking pool of people, and then you have a series of commonalities, and especially when they're unconscious.
So the smaller the pool of people, the less likely it is that certain coincidences would happen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the classic case is there's two people and one of them commits suicide and, you know, in a closed room, like some Sherlock Holmes movie, I mean, book or something. And who wrote it? The person who died or the other person? Now we have quite a closed set, you see, because the exigencies of the actual situation say that there are only two viable candidates.
Okay, so if I'm the defense attorney and you're saying to me, look, it looks like the person, the let's say it was the man didn't commit suicide and write the suicide note, it looks like his wife committed this, wrote the suicide note because it compares statistically in many ways with her writing styles. But what if I'm the guy who killed himself and I want to set up my wife and I study maybe her linguistic patterns and I write my suicide note as if I were her, so she would become a suspect if this became a murder trial? How do you determine if someone's not either dumbing down or smartening up the letter?
Right. So another very good question. And the answer is, you know, as I'll be doing training for police and intelligence agents and everything, and lay people, they say, oh boy, these guys were pretty stupid. I mean, they tried to dumb down, but they didn't do a good job. All criminals are stupid. I said, no, these are only the ones we catch. Maybe somebody does it really, really well, you see. But a classic case of this was a ransom note. And this was another case of Dr. Shai's, where the note misspelled daughter, misspelled all the cops, trash can was spelled with a K and stuff. But all sorts of other things were spelled correctly. And even more importantly, all the punctuation was perfect. And it belied the dumbing down of the person, see? So we can catch people very well because they don't dumb down. It's much easier to dumb down than dumb up, smarten up. Dumb down the same level. So if you can't spell trash can you actually do perfect punctuation in a 100-word note? Not bloody likely. See what I mean?
Well, do you have statistics on that? Like, are there studies of, okay, if someone's of a certain education level, this is how they do grammar, this is how they do spelling, this is how they do this, and it's statistical?
Well, you're using statistical as if it were a magic wand, and I get it. But the past many, many decades of sociolinguistic variation, which comes out of dialect studies. Let's look at this. I guess statistically or any other way, it would be very easy to prove that not Californians, because there are half of them are New Yorkers, but Eastern Tennessee speakers speak different than Western Tennessee speakers. And the way we would do that is we would collect, as many, many dialecticians have, actual samples of real speech and then compare them. So there would be a long, long list of differences that we could rely on.
A lot of people say, I didn't write that. And then people say, well, it came from your phone, from your email account. Well, my email must have been hacked,
yeah,
and someone sent out this letter. So that's a common defense that people use, like, for all sorts of things.
That's what that guy who got convicted of strangling his wife and little boys said, that somebody had hacked into his computer, but somebody would have had to be able to turn on the power, send it, and then turn off the power, which is rather difficult.
And can you also tell linguistically, oh, but he writes, whoever hacked into your computer happens to write in all the ways that East Tennesseans write,
yeah,
and you write.
That's right.
And here's the 50 ways that are similar to yours that are not necessarily similar to other people.
That's right. But it's also theoretically possible that somebody could do a really good job. So very often when death threats are public, we have to really watch out for copycats. And then whose underlying architecture is going to be different than the person who actually wrote it. And then when we get suspects, we want to be comparing the suspect's language to the genuine threats. And that's the complications in the real world of this forensic linguistics. Forensic linguistics is the most applied of all. It's the most real world application of theoretical linguistic science.
And so now let's get to specific cases. Like, you know, obviously one of the most famous cases in history is JonBenet Ramsey. How did you get involved in that case? What did you do for them?
Yeah, well, at the outset, I was probably one of the few forensic linguists in the world who was not involved when the poor girl was killed. But then later, a guy named John Carr, an American, surfaced in Thailand and announced that he had been there when JonBenet died and maybe was the killer, and that he was in love with her and he loved little girls and stuff like that. So he was able to get airlifted by the Boulder district attorney out of Thailand, where I am told he was in a lot of hot water, and brought to Colorado. And I was hired this time by a newspaper to compare his writings and this corpus of emails, that is, his writings were in a corpus of emails he had had with some professor who was the big expert on JonBenet Ramsey. And then I was supposed to compare these, once I had analyzed them, to the ransom note. And I said, there's not a lot of data here, but and the odds are he absolutely didn't write it. Because there are all these things that he does all the time that we do not find in the ransom note. Plus, there are perfect opportunities for it, you see? So, because they're a very, very close genre. When they're different genres, all sorts of things go haywire too. But his emails to the professor and the ransom note were very close in genre and et cetera. And yet, there were all these features that should have matched that didn't. So, the newspaper said, please, couldn't you say maybe? I said, no, what do you want from me? And every day on Good Morning America, there was a handwriting expert who said, I'll stake my reputation. John Carr, or whatever his name was, wrote the ransom note. And then the DNA evidence finally came back. No match. He had nothing to do with it. And people in the intelligence community tell me that he was just trying to get out of Thailand.
So could you take the ransom note, though, and compare it with all the other suspects and maybe investigate that way? Like, was did they do that?
Oh, yeah.
And they didn't really have any results?
Well, there's a lot of results. And my old FBI partner, a guy who brought me to Quantico to help him train his agents in the behavioral analysis unit, Jim Fitzgerald. Jim was the FBI agent who demonstrated to the FBI the utility, the usefulness of forensic linguistics in the Unabom case, which is a whole long story. But and there's a good TV show on it called Manhunt Unabomber, which is fictionalized, but the main character is named Jim Fitzgerald, and a lot of it is real. So anyway, Jim was having these week-long boot camps for behavioral analysis unit, other FBI agents, all sorts of people from overseas, allies, and he recruited me to go help him teach that. And when he retired, we moved that to Hofstra. And from then till right now, we have both in the fall and the spring, these intensive forensic linguistics, week-long classes all day, every day for a week. I teach them with Jim, and I teach with Tanya Christensen, fabulous forensic linguist from Denmark who works on all sorts of European cases. So Jim analyzed the JonBenet Ramsey letter and noted that there were real world links that linked it to the Ramseys. Well, number one, there was a crumpled up first draft in the garbage can, in the trash can. Now, you know, yeah, but also there were allusions to movies. So don't try to grow a brain, John. That's from a movie that they had apparently just rented or had rented in the recent past. If you do this, she dies. If you do that, she dies. If you do this, she dies. And that's also from another movie that they had rented. And this is why I'm saying, when you use language, you are leaving a trail of breadcrumbs to who, what movies you've seen, what sports you watch, where you're from, who your friends are, etc. So on the basis of that, Jim concluded, and I don't want to speak for him, but that it was probably Mrs. Ramsey who wrote it.
And but it doesn't necessarily mean she was the killer, but maybe she was just trying to get evidence away from her.
Yeah, well, there was a television show that looked at all of the evidence and tried to recreate the place, and they had hypothesized that it was Champagne's brother, who another little kid, who was probably killed her by accident and was jealous of her. And, you know, she was a beauty queen. And I mean, just such a terrible, heartbreaking thing. And I have no idea who killed anybody. And that's something that I really fight all the time. It's very hard for us to make believe we're like the forensic chemist in the basement who doesn't know the case, because we really have to know a lot about the case to be able to identify whether something is a clue or not. In the first case that I worked on, the fact that somebody used the term PC, and this was in 2006, led me to believe it was somebody who was very familiar with computers. And then it turned out that the main suspect was a computer specialist for the state police, of all things.
What's the story of the Tennessee Facebook murders?
It's just so horrible. One day, this couple in East Tennessee are found by a guy, I think, supposed to be getting his mail or giving a lift to the man, and finds a young man and woman both shot to death, man's throat slit, and the woman is holding their, I think, 20-month-old baby. He's unharmed. And now an investigation happens into a little town in eastern Tennessee. And the district attorney and his investigators in the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation start piecing together who might have had a motive or et cetera. And they finally zero in on this family who were having Facebook feuds, and that the press loved, you know, Facebook murders. It was because they defriended them on Facebook. Obviously, there was a lot of reason that they defriended them, and they just didn't want to deal with them anymore. And it came to light that there was a 30-year-old woman and her mom and her dad and her sort of boyfriend. And the dad was interpreting these things that he was reading on their Facebook pages as that his family was in danger from these, from this young couple. And he had been in Vietnam, and he always alluded to being a killer for the CIA. And actually, when they arrested him, I think there was something like 150 guns in his house. And he recruited the sort of boyfriend, and they went over in the middle of the night and shot and slashed the couple. So I come into the picture when they're trying to piece together where all this information comes from. And it turns out, to make a very, very long, terrible story short, the young woman and her mom were inventing all these dangers for themselves. And they had invented a CIA agent named Chris, who was sanctioning, approving the killing. And of course, people didn't stop to think, why would a CIA agent communicate to these men via this young woman's Facebook page? But that's what happens. People believe what they want to believe. And she and her mom put the two men up to the killings. And I was able to show that the Chris writings were from the mom and the daughter. It's a very, very terrible case.
So now, all these years later, it's like almost 50 years later, do you think you made the right decision?
Well, you know, the group's still going. Two of the original guys and three guys that I played with are still in the group, and they do gigs all the time. It's funny, when we started, a detractor said, they'll be gone in a couple of weeks. So 50 years later, the group is still going. And God, we had success. I mean, I played with every big 50s musician, Chuck Berry, and we played. We were really avant-garde, you have to understand. As I was saying before, I have this great handbill, a Detroit show with B.B. King, Little Richard, and us. Isn't that great? It's just fabulous, just fabulous. And played with all the biggest rock stars of the day and the dead, and you name it. It was a great experience to have had. And going to Africa, which we didn't even talk about, was also a fabulous experience that terrified me. I couldn't find out anything about the place that I was supposed to go to, a little island off the coast of Kenya, almost by the Somali border. I couldn't find out if there was electricity, if there were stores, nothing. And that was where I was supposed to be for a year. But I just, okay. And my father said, get going. I would have loved to be able to travel around the world when I was your age. So I don't want to hear it. And I said, you're right. You're right. I mean, I was terrified. And I packed up and I went there for a year. And altogether, I stayed there, for 6 years. Best place in the world, the most fun in the world.
Wow. And what did you study there? Like, what did you learn about forensic linguistics there?
Well, I learned a lot about language. You know, at Columbia, we always said, if we were urban sociologists, we wouldn't all study Detroit, right? People would study London and New York. So at Columbia, we had to specialize in a language. So some guys got French, somebody had Chinese, English. And because of Shana Na, I took Swahili. Out of 55 languages taught at Columbia, they were all taught Monday through Friday, except for Swahili. And when I was in the group, I would barely get back on Tuesday, you see? So I took Swahili, and the day I walked in there, I couldn't have found Africa on a map. That's how little I knew about it. And I love telling my students that. And I fell madly in love with it. Swahili, like a lot of Bantu languages, is incredibly complicated. There are 18 noun classes, otherwise known as genders. It's the equivalent of Spanish or French having 18 genders. And everything has to agree. Three of these genders have to do with different aspects of space and time. So for a guy who loves languages, I fell madly in love. So I specialized in it.
What does that mean, a gender that has to do with space and time? Like, what's an example?
Well, just to back up a sec, realize that gender in Spanish and French actually happens by accident almost, that if you're a man, you get the masculine, and if you're a woman, you get the feminine, but there's also neuter and German and all. And what makes a table feminine? It's la mesa in Spanish, but le table in French, it's masculine. Because there's no masculine. It's just a way of keeping track of things, okay? So Bantu languages do this up like mad. So the three noun classes, the three genders that have to do with space and time deal, roughly speaking, and my colleague that I took Swahili with and through PhD at Columbia, she has devoted many years to understanding this. But in general, at least the way when we teach it, to simplify it, we say one of these has to do with general space. One has to do with more specific space and is very often used for time. And then the third has to do with insideness, but really with borderness. So that's the semantic content that's being signaled. And then based on the context, it's being understood in all sorts of really interesting ways.
Well, it's so interesting. How do you say hello in Swahili?
Habari. It's a good, easy way And that's they borrowed from Arabic the word for news, khabar. So habari nzuri, if you're in Kenya, and if you're in Tanzania, nzuri. And then there's jambo greetings, where you say jambo, and you're supposed to say si jambo, and on like that. And people love to greet people there. I lived overlooking this square, and I would have to get my mail out of my post box, and it was maybe 100 feet, and it could take me 20 minutes, because everybody you meet, you have to say hello and ask how they are and how's their kids and how was their last safari. But it was wonderful. It was really wonderful, unless you were in a hurry.
Well, Robert Leonard, you have such an amazing story and background, from Shanana to solving murders and really achieving the top ranks of success in both very disparate fields. I read that Time magazine had listed you as number two of the world's smartest musicians, and it was certainly true. I don't know who number one was, but
he was the guitarist for Queen, and that's because he's an astrophysicist. I think I'm going to sue.
I like how, I don't know when that article was written. Hold on a second. I like how you instantly knew who your competitor was. It was written in 2012, so yeah. 11 years ago, and. You know, why? So he's an astrophysicist. I guess people think, oh, it's not rocket science. That's always
exactly.
kind of a metaphor for intelligence.
They have a great brand, astrophysicists, you know. I mean, and it's a great field, too. And he was an astrophysicist as he was the in Queen, just like when I was in school in Shanana. It's fun.
It's amazing. Well, Robert, thank you so much for coming on the show. And maybe you'll find a third field now.
Well, thank you. If you're any indication, I should try to become an interviewer. This was fabulous. I mean, I've been interviewed 8 million times, man. But this has been so insightful and so organized. And I'm not just saying that. I really have a lot of authentic data with which to compare it. I think you do a fabulous job. I listened to some of your podcasts, and they're just great.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I get really curious. And the problem is that I tend to interrupt because I make you stop and I'm like, wait, explain that. But I do get very curious. And
and you know your audience. It's just like when we use language, it's theory of mind. You know how things are going to be heard by your audience, as large as it is, because you have great experience in how they react.
Well, and what's interesting with this interview, and this is part of the podcast still, but what's interesting with this interview is a lot of times I interview people when they write a book, say, and they want to market their book. And I understand that. And if the book's interesting, I'll interview them and talk to them. But lately I've been leaning more towards interviewing people who themselves are the story, as opposed to they wrote the story. So you are an amazing story, and I loved hearing your stories, and it's very unique.
Wait, I have a book.
Oh, tell me the book. we'll market the book.
Well, my brother, who, as I say, you know, started Shanana, and he's also an excellent art scholar, but he wrote fabulous novels, all of which got picked up, and he wrote the screenplays. No movie was ever made out of him, but he's just a fabulous writer. He and I have been working for years and years now on a book that's very much like a John le Carré novel, but about the United States. And it's 1,300 pages. And we actually just finished it last week. That's why it was in my mind. And it is just love, death, courage, heartbreak, and centered around the intelligence world that I know something about, and centered around forensic linguistics as the key to the enigmas in the book. And yet it's a romance, and there are two heroines. There's a 30-year-old woman, a lawyer in New York, and a 14-year-old orphan out west. And they come together, and there's bombings and you name it. But at heart, it's a romance. It's about these two women.
And do you think you'll get it published?
Yeah. Maybe not as one 1,300-page book, but there's around 40 chapters that would make, I think, I mean, what with Netflix needing cliffhangers and endless. And we just loved Breaking Bad. And that was a great model for us to reorganize the novel. Because it is like, I don't know, three times as long as War and Peace. But each of the chapters stands on its own. So the special talent here that is revealed is the forensic linguistic that we've been talking about. And
yeah, that would create a great series, actually. Yeah. Like a James Patterson style series, you know, where the forensic linguist is like the Jack Reacher of the series.
Well, I have a book contract with Oxford University Press. I'm supposed to write a book about forensic linguistics for Popular People, and that's only 5 years late. I had a contract with the agent who had the Hunger Games books to write a young adult series on forensic linguistics, and that didn't work. But we're all back together again now, and we're hoping that this will be. It's only taken us years and years, I must say. So I needed a good agent, a good publisher, and we'll go to my brother's people, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, there's nothing wrong with self-publishing. You know, books like 50 Shades of Grey originally were self-published.
God help me.
And did your brother write There's Somebody Else on the Moon? I'm looking at Amazon.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's another George Leonard who was a self-help guy.
I see one called Mastery by another George Leonard, and then there's a George Leonard who's a doctor.
Yeah,
it's probably not that.
Not that either. But I mean, he gets reviews from the New York Times and the LA Times and everybody that just they cannot believe what a good writer he is. And
what's some of it? What's one of his books?
Beyond Control is one, and.
That's funny. So many soft porn books are named Beyond Control.
That's funny.
Yeah. Beyond Control by George Leonard.
Right.
I'm buying it right now.
Okay. It's a really good book.
It's $125 for the hardcover, so I'm going to buy it in the paperback.
I'll send you one, man. Matter of fact, I'll send you a copy of all of them.
All right. Excellent. Well, once again, Rob Leonard, Shanana, and Forensic Linguist. Thank you so much for coming on the show. You're welcome back anytime. I really appreciate it.
I'd love to, man. I'd love it. It's great talking to you. Thanks so much. Take care.